Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us. We have a number of participants from across the Atlantic, and it's my privilege to open this panel. My name is Leon Hartwell. I am a Sotroff Fellow at LSE Ideas. I'm also a non-resident senior fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis. Welcome to this first of several panels of LSE Ideas' Russia-Ukraine dialogues. Given the recent escalation of the war on the 24th of February, the conflict continues to be fluid and it requires cross-disciplinary analysis. Since the escalation, we're increasingly hearing reports about large-scale war crimes committed by Russia against Ukrainians. According to the UN, more than 2 million refugees have already fled Ukraine. Whether nuclear war is impending or not, the conflict threatens to deepen and spread way beyond the borders of Ukraine. How NATO and Western allies respond to this recent escalation of the Russia-Ukraine war will inevitably also have a major impact on the global order. LSE Ideas has set up the Russia-Ukraine dialogues in recognition that the war is one of the most consequential events of our time. With our dialogues, we would follow the conflict closely and promote factual discussions about the situation as it unfolds. We plan on having weekly panel discussions scheduled for every Tuesday, which will bring together in-house and external experts to report on and discuss the war's impact on various global issues. It is my privilege to introduce a very distinguished panel here. First, I would like to introduce Lieutenant General Ben Hodges. He holds the Pershing Chair in Strategic Studies at the Center for European Policy Analysis. He had a long and successful career in the US Army. His last military assignment was as Commanding General for the US Army Europe from 2014 to 2017. The second panelist is Professor Christopher Coker. He's the Director of LSE Ideas and an expert on war. I'm very excited to hear what you have to say today. And then we have Guy Monson, who is the Chief Investment Officer and a Managing Partner of Saracen & Partners. He's also a great friend of LSE Ideas. And another great friend of LSE Ideas is Susan Schofield, who is a visiting professor in practice at the University of Surrey. She has had a distinguished career in the civil service, held a variety of roles, and she brings a wealth of experiences to the table related to the Balkans, Northern Ireland, as well as nuclear issues. So I'm excited to ask you a number of questions today. Let's start off with Ben. So Ben, if you could unmute for us. Ben, if you were standing today in front of President Biden or Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, what would be your main observations in terms of what Russia has accomplished so far on the battlefield? Also, what do you think is President Putin's end state with this war? I know you also just got back to Germany from Washington, D.C., and that you spent time in Berlin. I'm therefore curious to hear whether there are any differences of opinion in terms of what we ought to be doing in relation to the Russia-Ukraine war. And perhaps you could say also something about whether there is a unified end state among NATO allies. Thank you, Ben.
Leon, thanks for the privilege of being on such a panel with also with, you know, kind of the kind of audience that you guys attract. So thank you for this. So I think if I was standing in front of those two gentlemen, they would think, oh my God, things have really gone bad. If Hodges is now who we've got to turn to for advice and assessment. But clearly what we're all watching is our Ukrainian forces and Ukrainian society overperforming against expectations, and Russian forces and Russian leadership underperforming against expectations. Certainly, I had higher expectations for Russian capabilities. In hindsight, as I look back at some other indicators that I missed, I should have been more skeptical about what they were going to be able to do. They clearly thought they could launch a rapid attack that would bring about the collapse of the Zelensky government, and then they could replace him with somebody to their own liking that would be willing to pull Ukraine back out of its Western, its move towards Western integration, the way Yanukovych did, actually. I'll say right up front that I believe that Ukraine is actually going to end up as the winner, if you will. And when I say winner, I mean that there will not be a decapitation of the Ukrainian government, that Kyiv will not fall. The Russians do not have the capability to be able to actually do that. Mariupol and Kharkiv are still standing. I doubt that they will be able to hang on to Kherson, which they reportedly captured a couple of days ago. The Russians have transitioned to attrition warfare because of their rapid advance failed, I think, in large part as a result of they don't have the experience and they hadn't trained at that sort of level to be able to pull that off. Whereas British, American, most European forces would practice these things all the time. Clearly the Russians had not practiced it. And so all the problems inherent in that type of operation revealed themselves, not to mention Ukrainian resistance. But the transition to attrition warfare, you have to have time, you have to have endless amounts of ammunition, and you have to have a lot of people. And the Russians have none of those three. They don't have time because Ukraine is only getting stronger as the West reacts. The sanctions are going to increasingly take a toll. And I think there's going to be some serious domestic pressure inside Russia that I would like for us to cover maybe in some detail later on as we go. 1 April is the next start date of the next Russian conscription intake. So about 130,000 Russian families are about to send their 19, 20-year-old son or brother to become cannon fodder in the Russian army. I think this is an opportunity for us. They don't have the ammunition, I don't believe, necessary because they don't produce everything that they use. They have to import some of it. That's already stopped. So they're not going to be able to replenish everything that they're expending. And ammunition expenditure always is higher in wartime than you ever planned for. That's been my experience for the last decades. Fuel consumption is always higher than you anticipate. And I think that because they're fighting in cities and trying to reduce these cities to rubble, the consumption rate is even higher than if they were just, you know, on the move, if you will. And I would note the idea of a no-fly zone, while I have signed a group letter endorsing it, because I was so anxious to see us try and do something that Ukrainians could see and feel. The no-fly zone is not going to solve the problem because most of this damage is not being caused by the Russian Air Force. Most of the damage is being caused by Russian artillery, rocket launchers, and surface-to-surface missiles. So what we really need to be doing, of course, is enabling the Ukrainians to go after those things with intelligence, special operations capabilities, their own long-range fires. The last point I would make is that on top of this being the best U.S. diplomatic effort I've seen since 1995 in terms of just comprehensive, in-depth, actual consulting versus informing or directing or cajoling, it's been impressive. And it's also been interesting that we've only seen Secretary Blinken. You almost never see the Secretary of Defense, Secretary Austin, or the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs General Milley. This obviously is part of the design. But in addition to the diplomatic effort led by the U.S., but essential with participation of so many allies, is the logistics effort. We now have 20 nations involved in delivering the stuff that Ukrainians need, not high-tech things that take forever to learn how to use, but things that you can put in the hands of a Ukrainian soldier with immediate effect. And it's only going to get better. So the logistics situation for Ukraine gets better with each day, while the Russian logistics situation worsens every single day. And the example of this, of course, is this gigantic parking lot north of Kyiv, where they're road bound. They can't get off the road because of the ground itself. And they're consuming all of the rations and gas that they were bringing to the fight. So it is a 24-mile long self-licking ice cream cone.
Thank you, Ben. Those are great initial observations to kick off this discussion. I'm now going to turn to Professor Coker. Please, would you share with us your initial observations of Russia's full-scale military invasion of Ukraine? What do you think went wrong with President Putin's plan? And also, could you provide us with some scenarios, given that you are very strong on military strategy? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Leon. Well, I think General Hodges has summed it up very well, what has gone wrong with Russian strategy. And that was going to be my first scenario. And what I wanted to do in the 5 minutes I have allocated is just to discuss what I think are the four most informed scenarios. Everybody has an idea of the end game. But I've been looking at 18 different media outlets. And here are, I think, the four most informed scenarios for what's going to happen. The first you've just heard from General Hodges is the one that I tend to be sympathetic to, that basically the Russians have lost and the Ukrainians have put up an extraordinary defense. Will mass prevail? Will the attrition rate prevail? Who knows? But I think that sanctions will take their toll, that the arms shipments are coming through fast, and that except for the south, where the Russians are not doing entirely badly, and Odessa might fall because they can take Odessa from the sea, perhaps, which is in terms of mobility very important, that basically they're in trouble. So the first scenario is that the Ukrainians can somehow get out of this and emerge victorious. The second scenario is that the Russians do take the capital, that Zelensky does fall. There is no shortage, by the way, of Ukrainian billionaires who'd be very willing to take his place. That basically the war continues, whatever winning means, reducing the cities to rubble, destroying Ukrainian infrastructure, displacing, of course, even more than 2 million refugees, which would generate the largest refugee crisis that Europe has witnessed since 1945-46, when 13 million Germans were displaced and moved back to Germany. And that having created complete chaos, he then says mission accomplished and withdraws. And you must remember at the Valdai conference last year, he did actually spend some time saying, I can live with chaos in a way that Western and liberal societies can't. So just because we think chaos is not a wonderful end state doesn't mean that he can't live without it. The third scenario is that he takes all of Ukraine and basically annexes it. And that leaves him, of course, with a resistance movement. He will need, I think, at least 500,000 soldiers, at least to be able to effectively occupy a country which is the size of France and Germany combined, with a population of 44 million people. I don't think he has those resources. He can mobilize those resources for any length of time. The resistance, as long as the resistance continues, sanctions continue, which will further weaken the Russian economy. And the resistance, by the way, doesn't have to take the form it did in the late 1940s and early 50s. The resistance movement in Ukraine only came to an end in 1954. We're talking about 21st century resistance, cyber attacks, anonymous attacks, outsourcing. The Ukrainians outsourced, for example, they bought drones on the open market in 2014. So basically, the third scenario is a quagmire, which continues for a year or two and then ends in a withdrawal, probably under Putin's successor rather than Putin himself. And the fourth scenario is a nightmare one for us, that Putin makes this into a war against the West. And he's already intimated that he's moving in this direction by saying that sanctions are an act of war, arms supplies are an act of war. He's gone on television, he's told the Russian people that basically this is no longer a war of liberation. This is World War III and it's already started. And that I think would lead to major cyber attacks against us. Always the prospect of accidental attacks on countries like Poland, not necessarily intended, but accidental. I mean, there's a great deal more military equipment that has now been moved forward in the last couple of months, possibly extending operations into Moldova and possibly using chemical weapons as he did twice in Syria. And even, of course, the prospect of a tactical or a dirty nuclear bomb, which he might think would shatter Western unity. And there is that prospect that Western unity would be severely tested if such a weapon were to be used. And we would end up basically with the beginnings of a European-wide war. I think, and this is my conclusion, the irony, of course, is that he could really have had it all. I agree with the Ukrainian foreign minister. If he had just annexed the republics, if he had just extended the corridor in Crimea, if he had not invaded Ukraine, the West would have been so relieved that I think that any sanctions that would have followed would have been quite minor in keeping with the sanctions in 2014. But of course, that has not happened. And so we're faced, or he is faced, with the prospect of Russia now being a pariah state, raising questions in Beijing about the usefulness of having Russia as a long-term ally, and showing the incompetence of the Russian armed forces, which must really come as an enormous shock and a challenge to his credibility in Moscow. Those, I think, are the four most likely scenarios. I tend to think General Hodges is right, and the first scenario is the one that I probably would bet on if I were a betting man, which I'm not.
Thank you, Christopher. I appreciate it. I'm now going to turn to Guy Monson, and I'd like to ask you about sanctions. You are a great expert on issues related to finance. So my question to you is, in terms of international sanctions, these sanctions on Russia's banking system meant that Russia is unable to receive payments for certain exports, pay for imports, engage in a variety of cross-border financial transactions. What are you seeing in terms of the initial impacts of these sanctions related to SWIFT, and what do you foresee for the coming weeks and months, both for Russia and for the global economy? Thank you. I think you might be muted.
Thank you, Leon. We see broadly in the financial markets, the Russian invasion is broadly something similar to 9/11, an event that will determine government foreign policy and military policy for years ahead. And the markets are broadly reacting in that way. First of all, where are the pressure points? Well, obviously commodity prices, you've seen at the top end of Russian produced commodities, nickel up 160%, wheat up 98%, oil up 90% year on year. So very large moves. The particular worry area is the food market. The UN, famous UN food price index, now up 21% through its 2011 highs. Remember back in 2011, Libya and Egypt saw political disturbances brought on by food. So food pressures on the food side. Looking next at the Western markets and how they're responding, well, the answer is relatively benignly, thank goodness. Since the declaration of actual war on the 23rd, 24th of February, the world equity index is only down 4%. Europe's down more, about 10%. Bond yields are off about 10 basis points, not much. And the dollar has appreciated only modestly. The impact is greater the nearer you get to the region, so the declines are more in Europe. But you're not seeing anything like the feed-through effects you saw, say, of a Lehman's crisis. In general, of course, inflation is high at a 40-year high, so there is an assumption that this war activity, will make central banks less eager to tighten, and that, of course, gives support to financial assets. So barring the acute pressures in certain commodity markets, the West is actually quite robust to date. By contrast, the events in Russia are traumatic, and there I would definitely compare this to a Lehman's moment. The data's not good because many stock markets are closed, but the ruble is off 60%. The last snapshot we had of an effective trading Russian equity index was off 70%. And falling. I know a lot of individual funds that hold Russian equities who've priced them at zero. So the numbers are very dramatic. The measure that we have from the swaps market on the likelihood of default was 56% last week, rising to 80% this week. So I think a liquidity crisis and technical default is highly likely. The effect of the sanctions comes in three ways. First of all, obviously, the general sanctions on business activity, which are having a chilling effect and triggering a lot of self-sanctioning. You've seen the oil companies refuse to accept Russian oil deliveries. You've seen a whole lot of commodity traders refuse to trade with their Russian counterparts. You're now seeing organizations like Morgan Stanley Capital International, which runs equity market indices, FTSE, JP Morgan, refuse to include Russian securities in their underlying indices. This has huge implications for flows going forward. The second area is the obviously the SWIFT restrictions on banks. Of course, while one bank is still unsanctioned, all the other banks in Russia can pool their transactions and push that through the one bank. So you really need a total SWIFT blockade to do the to create the effect you want. But this is having a huge impact already on financial payments, and fear of wider sanctions is very clear. Thirdly and finally, you've got the technology transfers, which will have particular effects, as we know, in the aerospace industry and across the electronics and other industries. Just to give you an idea of how those might be felt, if you look at non-food imports in Russia, 75% are imported. So if you get a combination of SWIFT, a combination of self-sanctioning, and a combination of export restrictions, you can see the impact on the underlying supply picture. So I think this is a Lehman's moment. JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs are predicting a decline of about 8% in Russian GDP this year. Bloomberg are higher at the number of 9% of Russian GDP. If you compare that to what happened in the 98 default in Russia, -5.8, and in Lehman's, -7.8. So this is bigger than both of them. So I think it's highly effective. Just briefly on the outlook from here, one favorable position for the West is obviously momentum was quite high coming out of the pandemic crisis. So the IMF have pulled global growth figures back from 4.9% to 4.4%. They'll probably revise that down. But we're not anywhere near yet a global recession. So we're working from a position of strength. Particularly households have built up large balances from high saving rates during the pandemic, and that'll offset some of the effect of higher cost of living, which is going to squeeze incomes. Just finally, one side effect that has emerged, of course, is a much stronger EU. You've seen it in their own response. I would take particular note this morning of the decision to issue mutualized bonds to support the diversification of energy agenda and the defense agenda. Remember that for the first time in the history of the EU, we issued mutualized bonds of 1.8 trillion euros to fund the COVID pandemic effort. This is now a new program, potentially much larger. So as often we see in times of crisis, the EU evolves, and in this case, in a positive direction.
Thank you, Guy, especially for putting together all those incredible figures to give us a great sense of what's been happening with global markets, but also the impact on the Russian economy. And I hope we can pick up on some of those points during the just the Q&A session. I'd now like to turn to Susan. You know, there are many things we could talk about given some of the issues that you've worked on. I'd like to talk a little bit about the scale of the refugee issue here. The UN says that we've already witnessed 2 million refugees who have fled Ukraine. And I think if we put that into perspective, you know, when we look at the Yugoslav wars, for example, in Bosnia during 92 to 95, I think there were 2 million people who were displaced in Bosnia during that period. So the scale of this crisis is extraordinary, and it has the potential, as Christopher also mentioned earlier, to be much greater than what we're seeing now during the early days of this escalation of the conflict. Could you perhaps comment about the humanitarian crisis that we're anticipating at this point?
Yes, I will do so. I hope that some of those scenarios don't come to pass. I do think that is actually quite an important influencing factor. I mean, at the moment, very strong support, particularly from Poland and other nearby states where the main refugee flows are coming. May that continue, and may those flows not be tragically attacked. If the finances of nations continue to be strong, if we are in scenario one, which I also very much hope we are, I think then the issues will become, as we see, for example, in the UK, in terms of the difficulty of actually integrating, particularly people who have come from Afghanistan, who we've invited into the country. Many are still in hotels in inadequate accommodation. They haven't been integrated properly and fully into the communities where they are. They don't have a long-term home. Children aren't in education. People aren't necessarily, I think in many cases, very few people are actually employment. So the country, UK, has not coped well with that really strategically very important sense of solidarity. Now, I get the sense that European nations in general have in some cases integrated people, refugees, much more effectively. If those systems remain in place and can cope with this influx, then I imagine that we may see people, refugees moving from Poland, either back to their homes in Ukraine, as we would all hope, or looking sort of to the longer term, where do they think they would be best placed and best received? And we may see then onward movement, Nordic countries, for example, etc. And in some cases, between those two extremes, we may well find that people would go to the neighboring states, the immediate neighboring states of Ukraine, from perhaps Poland. Now, in the very, very worst circumstances, I think this is going to be a key part of, were there any World War III, and for heaven's sake, please no, then I think there could be really devastating impact and a true, true humanitarian crisis on a scale not seen for very long time. Perhaps on that really cheerful note, given we're just at the introductory stage, I'll stop. But I would just say, for me, I share the view that this is really rather, in terms of the United Kingdom, a 9/11 moment, in that realization that we had got lazy in our national contingency planning, in our national resilience, and we needed to rethink our whole approach to these sorts of events. I think that would be similarly. And I think actually I would count this as our 9/11 moment for these matters, and particularly on the humanitarian side. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Susan. Thank you for those reminders. I'm going to turn to Ben next, just to ask one or two more questions to you. Ben, several nations have rapidly begun the process of supplying weapons to Ukraine, including thousands of anti-tank weapons, some say 17,000, and surface-to-air missiles. How long will it take to have a significant impact on the balance of power in Ukraine, in your estimate? And I think a related question to that, more important perhaps, is can we provide more support to Ukraine without escalating the conflict? Thank you.
Well, I think we're already having a significant effect, just looking at all the videos of destroyed Russian vehicles that are out there. So clearly there's an effect, and I believe this is only going to increase the vulnerability of Russian supply columns, for example. I mean, the Ukrainians are very quick and very adaptive. I've witnessed this over the last 8 years, and I think that they are moving towards that big fat convoy like hungry wolves, whether it's special forces or territorial forces that are out there. Being in that convoy is not a healthy place to be. And my sense is that the availability of these kinds of weapons, especially the anti-tank weapons, is only increasing. The air defense weapons, on the other hand, we got a much later start there, which is unfortunate, but that's where we are. So Stinger and other similar systems are beginning to arrive. Those will be very useful against helicopters and drones. The Russian Air Force just has not been as visible as I had expected. That could be a number of reasons, out of force protection or maintenance readiness. I don't know. I imagine Chris probably has a better sense of that than I do. But I think these weapons are having effect already. Now, you asked me a second part of that question. What was it?
Apologies. Sorry. The second part of the question is, can we provide more support to Ukraine without escalating the conflict?
Well, this is a real question. And I think the pressure on the Biden administration and on others is going to be immense and only growing over the next week as we continue to see videos of Ukrainian civilians being murdered, apartments being hit deliberately. I think for the third time in a row now, a so-called humanitarian corridor was attacked by the Russians after they had agreed to it. I mean, this is who we're dealing with. Nobody should be confused about who it is we're dealing with. So what can we do to relieve that sort of pressure, assuming that no NATO nation is going to break ranks and do something inside Ukrainian airspace and on the Ukrainian territory? And because protecting the unity of the alliance is also an essential part of this entire effort. So what can we do to take pressure off of Ukraine? Obviously, the delivery of capability needs to be on the scale of the Berlin airlift. I mean, 24/7, and it does feel like we're starting to grow in that regard. There needs to be a how do we, working within that constraint, how do we get the initiative? What can we do that will help Ukraine get the initiative? Giving them the capability to make the commander of the Black Sea Fleet feel very uncomfortable in his illegal base in Sevastopol, for example. That would be something. Or letting it be known that that big fat bridge over the Kerch Strait, Ukrainians now possess the weapons that could drop that bridge. And then external, what Secretary Ash Carter used to call horizontal escalation, maybe letting it be known that we're considering a naval quarantine, not a blockade, but a quarantine of the Russian Navy base in Tartus in Syria, or a SNAPEX in Georgia, or something up in the Arctic, to force the Russians to have to look elsewhere. Now, there will be people that will wet themselves that this is an escalation. That there's nothing else we can do other than perhaps a land operation inside Ukraine that's going to provoke the Russians. I mean, they are already operating well beyond what I think most of us assume that they would do. And then continued information operations. I mean, we have got to reach the Russian population. Imagine if 100,000 families said, no, my son is not going to report on conscription day on the 1st of April. I mean, imagine if only 50,000 said that. That would be an earthquake inside Russia.
Thank you, Ben. I know you almost have to jump off from this call for your next interview. So I'll just ask you one more brief question. Could you comment perhaps about some of the images that we've seen over social media that Ukrainians have taken with their mobile phones, and there are now, there's a lot of talk about war crimes. I mean, you have a very good understanding of what war crimes entail. Do you have any initial comments on that for us?
War is not a ballet. It never follows the script. And the longer it goes on, the brutality increases. I mean, we know this from thousands of years, no matter what century you're in. And I don't want to see everybody walk around taking pictures of dead bodies. It's also a violation to use prisoners of war, taking their pictures and then posting them everywhere. That's inappropriate. If Ukrainians go too far in this regard, they may end up losing some of the moral high ground. Not a lot. I mean, there's no danger of the world changing sides here, but their cause is a good cause, and I think we want to. These are the kind of things. If I was a commander, I would be making sure that none of my soldiers are taking pictures of dead bodies, posting these anywhere. That's inappropriate. But it does raise a couple of important points. How in the world is President Zelensky able to walk around downtown Kyiv with his iPhone? I mean, that's incredible. It's either incompetence or an oversight, or for some reason the Russians were not able to shut down the ability of Ukrainian leaders to communicate. They're on TV everywhere. They're on their phones. They're as if there is zero Russian ability or effort to shut that down. To me, I think when the history of this war is written, that's going to be one of the decisive failures or shortcomings, because the personal leadership of President Zelensky has had such a strategic effect outside of Ukraine as well as inside Ukraine. I think this is one thing. And then the ability to command and control. I mean, day one of lieutenant school is, you try to disrupt the enemy's ability to command and control. They've not been able to do that. And I can't quite figure that out. The information domain is so much more important now. And, the example of President Zelensky on his phone is critical. This is why the Russians, of course, have shut down all social media and put up a wall to make sure that Russians are not able to see what actually is going on. This is part of the competition that we've got to win by make sure the truth gets inside of Russia. I would advise everybody, when you hear numbers, unless you count the bodies yourself, I never believe body counts. I mean, that was a gross failure on our part in Vietnam. And there was a tendency to start doing that in Afghanistan again, because you're looking for some tangible measures of success. That is never a good success. I don't know how many Taliban and Al-Qaeda leaders we killed that never slowed down terrorist efforts. So body counts, I would never trust them. Seeing how many fuel trucks are destroyed, that tells me something. If they're able to start destroying all these fuel trucks, that will have an effect.
Thank you, Ben. I'm now going to turn back to Professor Coker also. And I just want to comment based on something that you said, Ben. Maybe a strategic priority for NATO should be to keep Ukraine's communication systems alive and support them with that. But Christopher, maybe here's a question from Derek West. He's asking, is the West at war with Russia? And if so, what will Russia's defeat look like? Thank you.
I would say we've been at war with Russia for the last couple of years in terms of cyber conflict, cyber subversion, cyber espionage, disinformation, interference in the electoral cycles, Brexit right. Referendum. We can all question how important the Russian factor was in deciding the outcome of elections or the outcome of the referendum. I don't think it was decisive. But this kind of interference in internal affairs is an act of war below the nuclear threshold. Now it is quite plain that the West has decided, or a number of leading contenders in the West has decided, that Putin has to go, that you can't live in a world with Vladimir Putin any longer. The extraordinary extent to which he lied month after month about the invasion of Ukraine has not been seen. Even in the Cold War, you would not have seen that. The extent to which Macron was personally humiliated time after time. Now, there will be many Western countries that believe that's too high a price to pay. But the big question now is, if we don't defeat Putin now, we're going to have to defeat him on another occasion when we're going to be less united and when we won't have Ukraine doing most of the fighting and doing it very effectively. So the fact that, we believe that the Putin regime has to go is, I think, now generally agreed in Paris and in Berlin and in Washington. Of course, we're not going to do it in terms of invading Russia or staging or trying to stage decapitation. We're hoping the Russians will do it themselves. But the longer he is seen to be not the great strategic champion, the chess player that everybody thinks he is, he's a judo player. I mean, in judo, you win by taking advantage against your enemy. But judo is essentially a tactical game, not a strategic game. Chess is a strategic game. He's a tactician, not a strategist. And he's been let down by his military. We have to remember the reason why the Ukrainian military has done so well is that they sacked their defense minister after 2014. They decentralized their military system. They reformed their military system, brought younger commanders along. And unfortunately for the Russians, they're still stuck with a ridiculous and useless defense minister, a highly over-centralized system. And they've learned very little from experience. The Ukrainians have learned a lot, which is why they have the superior military force now, not in terms of numbers, of course, but certainly in terms of ability, capability, and imagination.
Thank you very much, Christopher. I'll ask you another question while we're discussing this issue. It's a question from Lee Jones. The idea that Putin has already lost seems to rest on the assumption that Russia aims to conquer Ukraine and install a puppet government. Is it not possible that his goal is to inflict serious damage on the Ukrainian military and then settle for occupation of Donetsk and Luhansk? How do we know what his minimum war aims actually are?
I think we know his minimum war aims because he stated them yesterday, what he would accept for suspending the campaign, and that is neutralization of Ukraine, a change of government. Zelensky has to go, a new person in power, of course, the annexation of the Donbas region, and of course, the extension of that territory and the corridor from Crimea. Now, that, he said, are his minimum aims. If we agree to all of those, if Ukraine agrees to all of those, we'll have the end of fighting. And that, of course, is a series of demands that cannot be met by any self-respecting Ukrainian government. So his only alternative now is to create so much damage that at some point the Ukrainians will decide, will lose the political will to continue the fight. That's what he's hoping to achieve as they see their country gradually disintegrate around them.
Thank you, Christopher. I appreciate it. I'm going to turn back to Guy now. Guy, you mentioned there are a few loopholes with regards to the SWIFT system and the sanctions that are currently in place. Could you please elaborate on what else the international community can do to make this conflict more expensive for the Putin regime, to the point where continuation of this war would hurt more than ending it?
Yes. In the immediate terms, the most effective decision taken so far is the sanctioning of a central bank. And remember, this is really exceptionally unusual and aggressive. And it almost looks as if this decision wasn't wargamed properly by the Russians, because they left somewhere around 50 to 60% of assets at Western depositories, which have effectively been sanctioned. So the first thing that where they could get relief is to turn to China. They've got about 13% of their central bank deposits in RMB. They could also ask China to buy off them their large gold holding for dollars to address that balance. So some mitigation of the freezing of central bank assets by the Chinese would be helpful. The elephant in the room, of course, is obviously energy sanctions. We've all been discussing this. It looks like the Biden regime will push to sanction Russian oil. At the present, of course, the move upward in price is far exceeding the move downward in demand. So the cash flow effect is still there. So it's a complex question, that. But of course, the world has experience with Iranian oil, and there is a possible model that this could be achieved over the medium term. But I think that is a medium term goal. What else could the West do? I don't say it, but we're approaching maximum sanctions. I mean, we've just no historic experience of an economy operating under this measure of private and public restriction. It's far in excess of what we've seen in Iran. This will be the most sanctioned country in the history of modern sanctions. So I think just sitting back and waiting for these to take effect is a powerful strategy in itself. Now, of course, there's some debate over whether you should offer some relief from the most aggressive sanctions as a means of climb down in terms of negotiating with Mr. Putin, and that's entirely possible. But at the moment, there'll be incidental components added onto this. There'll obviously be some maturing of the energy picture. But on the ground, yes, you could extend SWIFT a little bit further. These are absolutely unprecedented, and the follow-up from the private sector is going to hurt even more. So I think we're almost at maximum impact.
Thank you, Guy. Can you also please maybe just elaborate a little bit more on the difference between sanctioning Russia's oil market versus the gas market, for example? Right now, it looks like the US is about to place sanctions on the oil market. From my understanding, it won't hurt the US much because there's not a massive dependency on Russian oil. But, would it be the same for some of the European, some of our other European allies, for example? And then, perhaps you can also shed some light on what the discussion is with regards to the gas market. Thank you.
Russia is the world's second largest gas supplier. It's the third largest oil manufacturer at the moment. The money is in oil. That's where the real revenue comes from. But of course, unlike gas, oil is highly fungible. You can move it around and sell it to different markets. I don't think we really have a model for what would happen of an effective sanctioning of Russian oil yet. I would assume the price continues upward. At some point, those sanctions lock down and a surplus arises, and then the price begins to react. We're seeing a little bit of a taste of it. We've got a $14 per barrel difference between Brent and Urals, which is one of the biggest spreads that we've ever seen, and that is continuously widening. And we're hearing across the world talk of international oil companies not taking Russian shipments. The gas position, of course, is much more static in that you depend on existing gas networks for almost all of Russia's oil exports. The UN number for oil dependency in Europe is 50%. The Eurostat number is 42%. It's somewhere between the two of them. That can't, of course, be replaced overnight, but I wouldn't underestimate this joint funding initiative and the sort of money that could be deployed in Europe to get some sort of independency. So I think they'll move first on oil. I don't think Germany certainly is in a position to sanction Russian gas yet. And I'm not sure yet how the price will react, but the sign that it is working is to look at the spread between Urals and Brent.
Thank you. Thank you for your insight, Guy. I'm now going to turn to Susan again. We have a question here from the audience, from one of the audience members. The threat of nuclear war or World War III is the main deterrence of NATO's military involvement in the Russian invasion towards Ukraine. Even President Putin's threat worked in this war. Will he stop after annexing Ukraine? What if he continues his aggression after Ukraine? The West is still facing the nuclear threat. Is the West going to retaliate?
Well, that's an interesting and important question. I mean, I think retaliate how would be my question. My proposal would be by showing actually our resilience, by building our resilience. And in that sense, not leaping to, you know, pressing buttons both ways. I do say that because I'm of the generation when NATO members practiced every year what were called Wintex and Hilex exercises, which included not only going through the steps that would lead to exchange of weapons, but also practicing what we would do afterwards. And NATO nations went through those exercises and really understood how their fundamental national resilience could be supported through the most grim of times. I think we need to get back to that degree of national resilience under the worst of circumstances, because we have again got lazy. We have thought it wouldn't happen. And that for me is a far more powerful and effective way of responding. And it is a response, and it will be an expensive response. But it also, I think, will be the best way. Now, if Putin carries on regardless, then I think one would go back to all these alternative methods of undermining his regime, and I put it like that, and get into that grey zone, as it's called, that grey zone action, where indeed I would agree for the last 2 or 3 years he has been operating. I think we should ourselves operate in the grey zone, below that nuclear threshold, if you will, but in ways that can be absolutely, arguably, as if not more destructive, and specifically to the Putin regime, and unfortunately, probably Russia too.
Thank you, Susan. We have more questions here directed at you from some of the audience members. Given your experience with regards to the conflicts in the Balkans and with regards to Northern Ireland, there's quite a lot of interest in your thoughts on war termination, what it would look like, what it could possibly look like with regards to this conflict. Can we really expect Putin to throw his cards in if Zelensky is winning? Why would he stop before he has a victory? So, and also related to that, who can we expect to perhaps mediate this conflict?
Well, that again is a very interesting question. In both Balkans and Northern Ireland, there had been, there was something that all parties wanted, if you will, on which they could unite. In the Balkans, it was possible by offering essentially EU membership after a period of rebuilding social society, rule of law, social development, to offer membership of the European Union. And a few met that really quite high level and joined the European Union. But that work had started in many ways. We had the time to work up to it. And it was done through inviting key players, normally those who might be the supporters of particular factions, into a safe space, like Wilton Wilton House, where people will remember, perhaps, I don't know if members of the MSC group are in, on these calls, but those kind of negotiations were extremely effective. And thus you had someone who was trying to persuade with offerings of something really quite interesting and powerful. All the factions in the former Yugoslavia were all keen on joining the European Union. It was something everybody found economically attractive, even amongst the rival factions. So it was the one thing almost that they could agree on. Now, trying to translate that into how one approaches these circumstances, I find challenging, shall we say. But usually the UN Security Council members here are very important. And the P5 plus, that is plus UK and France, the nuclear powers. They, I think, could play a role. Now, what happened and enabled progress in the Balkans was that China said that their vital interests were not involved, so they sort of abstained. So there were UN Council resolutions could be passed, so on and so forth. And there the Russians did take part, and they were the sponsors of the Serbs, if you will. So the sponsors negotiated amongst themselves and then negotiated with the parties. Now, I'm trying to think of a parallel here. I mean, I could imagine if he would do it, President Xi could be quite important in this in regard and could show considerable leadership. So he has perhaps a choice. Does he align himself and China with President Putin and Putin's Russia? Or does he play a different world leadership role? Now, I don't know. The challenge is in that in itself. But I do think who the sponsors are going to be, who will be doing the negotiation amongst themselves, will be a critical issue, getting those to come forward, those who might be effective. That, I think, will not happen swiftly. So there's again a question, how swift? Which is where I think it is very interesting, the war crimes issue, and already that the international criminal, the people are actually already engaging, and the president of the tribunal has actually said this is something that we are interested in taking forward. I think that is extremely important.
Thank you. Thank you, Susan. And I want to thank all the panelists also for being part of this discussion. This is only an initial sort of icebreaker session to kick off one of many discussions on the situation in Ukraine and this war between Russia and Ukraine. Over the coming weeks, we are planning to do multiple sessions. We will do it on Tuesday at the same time every week. We will have general discussions like this one to kind of get a state of play of the situation, just given the fluidity of the situation, before we will dive into more specific issues. And I can imagine, based on some of the discussions, some of the points that were raised today, that we would move more into setting up panel discussions on more thematic issues, on specialized issues related to humanitarian issues, war crimes, sanctions, cybersecurity, and also the impact of this conflict on Putin's regime, to name a few. So on that note, I'd like to thank everyone again for coming, and we hope to see you back during the same time next week. Thank you.